Welcome to episode 2 of Allegedly Evident. This is the Burger Chef murder series. Let's get started with part 2, Silent Screams.
Burger Chef, a bustling fast food haven at 5725 Crawfordsville Road in Speedway, Indiana, found its place in the heart of a unique locale. Speedway, an incorporated city within the city limits of Indianapolis, resides in the west central and northwest portion of the more significant metropolis. The strategic positioning of the restaurant on an extension of Interstate 74 near the beltway surrounding Indianapolis bestowed it with convenient access to all major highways, making it a hub for locals and travelers alike. The surrounding area along Crawfordsville Road painted a vibrant picture of commerce and convenience. Dominated by stores, motels, fast food establishments, and shopping centers, the landscape was a testament to the hustle and bustle of modern life. An all-night donut shop, a beacon for those seeking a late-night treat, stood proudly west of the restaurant, while a closed service station, temporarily silent, occupied the space to the east. Behind the restaurant, a set of railroad tracks ran southwards, creating a boundary that marked the transition between commercial activity and the quieter realms of residential living. Beyond the tracks lay a lower middle-class residential area where families carved out their daily routines in the shadow of the fast-paced world that unfolded along Crawfordsville Road. The strategic placement of Burger Chef within this dynamic environment made it more than just a fast food joint. It became a communal meeting point, a place where the pulse of Speedway resonated through the clinking of utensils, laughter, and the aroma of sizzling burgers. Little did anyone know that this seemingly ordinary restaurant in the heart of a bustling community would soon become the focal point of a tragic and unforeseen event that would forever alter its place in the collective memory of Speedway, Indiana. 3 weeks before the fateful night of November 17, 1978, Mark continued to rebel against his father. He came home from school and entered another Caucasian girl's apartment. His father found out and went looking for him. He told his father he just went into her apartment to smoke. His father told him to leave her alone. A week later, Mark was caught with the same girl again. In the days leading up to the ominous November 17, 1978, Jane was entangled in a web of unsettling events that would ultimately set the stage for a tragic night at Burger Chef. It all began with unnerving prank calls that disrupted Jane's peace of mind. The intrusive calls reached their disturbing climax on Friday, November 10, 1978, when an unknown caller delved into the inappropriate territory of inquiring about her attire. Disturbed by the encounter, Jane promptly hung up, attempting to brush off the unsettling intrusion as a seemingly harmless prank. Meanwhile, the vigilant employee Daniel uncovered misconduct behind the scenes at Burger Chef. Two employees were discovered behind the establishment, prompting Daniel to inform the manager swiftly. The consequences were severe, with the errant employees facing termination for actions deemed unacceptable within the confines of the fast food establishment. Amidst these unsettling occurrences, Mark, having learned about a recent robbery and murders at a steakhouse fast food restaurant in Oklahoma, extended a gesture of protection to Jane. Aware of the potential dangers, he expressed his willingness to shield her during a theft, using his karate skills for reassurance. However, the Burger Chef was not immune to internal challenges. Jane faced difficulties with a male employee whose termination became inevitable due to drug abuse. The decision to let go of an employee within the last 2 weeks hinted at a workplace grappling with its issues, creating an atmosphere of tension and unease. As the clock ticked away, the fateful November 17, 1978, unfolded. The familiar routine of the evening at Burger Chef on Crawfordsville Road in Speedway, Indiana, began like any other. Unaware of the impending tragedy, the employees went about their routines with anticipation for the night ahead. Jane, the central figure in this narrative, embarked on her day by visiting her friend, Charlie, as the clock struck noon. Jane and Charlie used to work together approximately 2 years before that fateful night. Management policy forbade socializing between employees, so Charlie searched for alternate employment so that they could continue to date. At one time, they had discussed marriage, but after about 1 year, they broke up. Charlie and Jane remained friends and saw each other occasionally, clad in light brown slacks and a black striped sweater. Jane assured her friend Charlie that she would comply with any demands imposed during such a hypothetical situation, when discussing the many times that Charlie had been robbed at work. However, Charlie continued to worry about her strong and emotional personality. Jane planned to return home on Westbury North Drive, Westlake Arms, Indianapolis, for a wardrobe change into her burger chef uniform. Mark previously agreed to work for a 17-year-old Caucasian female coworker, Ginger Haggard, so she could go on a date with another coworker, a 17-year-old Caucasian male, Brian Kring. Mark found himself entangled in a series of decisions with far-reaching consequences. After school, a phone call to Ginger unfolded a chain of events, with Mark explaining that his grandmother's presence in town prevented him from working her shift. In a collaborative effort to navigate the situation, Ginger sought assistance from Brian, who graciously offered to help her clean up at the end of her shift, allowing them to leave earlier for their planned date. However, Ginger's curfew posed a challenge, prompting her to contact Mark again, insisting that he fulfill his work commitment. The Burger Chef employees went about their pre-shift routines as the day progressed. Despite having a driver's license, Ruth's mom, Rachel, picked her up from school and whisked her home to Lupine Drive in Indianapolis for a swift uniform change. Ruth now adorned in her Burger Chef attire a hat, a blue-gray hooded below knee-length coat with an oversized plaid pattern, fur around the bottom of the sleeves and at the base of the coat, and brown lace-up shoes with crepe soles, embarked on her journey to work. At 3:45 p.m., Rachel dropped Ruth off at work. As the sun dipped lower in the sky, at 4:10 p.m. Mark and his sister India Flemons, age 20, left the comfort of their parents' house and walked to the Burger Chef. Mark's Burger Chef top, adorned with brown and orange hues, paired seamlessly with medium brown knit pants that boasted belt loops, but lacked a belt. He chose burgundy-colored shoes, earth soles, made of suede with a one-piece rubber sole and five eyelets at the front. To shield his eyes from the ambient lights, Mark sported non-prescription sunglasses. The digital Timex watch on his left wrist ticked away the moments, its silver face contrasting against the black strap. Over his uniform, Mark wore a light blue windbreaker jacket, its zipper securing the front, albeit with a small tear in the upper right sleeve area. The jacket's collar held a pocket that cradled the hood, a detail of both fashion and practicality. As the hands of the clock approached 4:30 p.m. on that unassuming day, Mark stepped into the familiar confines of the Burger Chef, donning the quintessential uniform of his role. Meanwhile, Jane's brother, James, referred to as Jimmy, escorted his son Dutch to the Burger Chef that evening. Seeing Mark practicing karate moves by the fryers as they entered caught Dutch's attention. Daniel, referred to as Danny, arrived at the Burger Chef in a bronze 1973 Ford Pinto station wagon, carefully parking on the west side of the lot and ensuring the security of his vehicle by locking its doors. Daniel's attire painted a vivid picture: dark brown Levi-type pants, Sears Pitt on shop brand, size 3128, dark-colored socks, a greased-covered pair of Sears brown over tan leather tennis shoes, size 8 or 8.5 wide, a white t-shirt, and a Burger Chef jacket adorned with the name tag Dan. Completing his ensemble was an old, faded denim Wrangler jacket with fleece lining, bearing the size 40 or 42. He packed his blue flannel shirt to change into after his shift. His prescription glasses framed his focused gaze, and a 1980 Decatur Central High School ring, with a blue stone and the initials DRD engraved inside, spoke of his journey. He locked his car doors before entering the Burger Chef and clocking in alongside India at 5 o'clock p.m. Little did these individuals know that the seemingly routine actions of this day would converge in a series of events that would forever alter the course of their lives and the quiet town of Speedway, Indiana. The stage was set for a night filled with unexpected twists and tragic turns, where ordinary moments would soon be overshadowed by the darkness that loomed on the horizon. As the evening descended upon Speedway, Indiana, on November 17, 1978, the ordinary routine of the town began to intertwine with the impending events that would alter the course of history. As the evening unfolded, the Burger Chef became a meeting point for friends and a backdrop for casual encounters. At 6 o'clock, PM Brian arrived to pick up Ginger for their planned date, an evening that, unbeknownst to them, would soon take an unexpected turn. By 7 o'clock, PM Brian and Ginger, in the early stages of their night out, made a casual stop at the Burger Chef. Little did they know that Mark, a key figure in the unfolding narrative, would add a touch of humor to their visit by playfully refusing to engage in conversation with Ginger. Jane would tape the arches of her feet with 1-inch-wide tape before leaving for her shift at the Burger Chef to prevent her feet from getting sore. She locked her door as she exited her white 1974 Chevrolet Vega. She always locked her door when getting out. She was persistent that she and anyone riding with her lock her car doors. As the clock struck 8 o'clock, PM Jane stepped into her role for the night shift. Jane embodied the essence of the Burger Chef's requirements. Clad in her uniform, a white blouse paired with an orange and brown striped ascot, brown pants, and brown vinyl or smooth leather shoes, she added a flair with a short, slick, dark brown leather coat that Charlie bought her. Her hair, tied up in compliance with the establishment's regulations, adorned her in a no-jewelry ensemble. Simultaneously, India concluded her shift, marking a transition in the dynamics of the Burger Chef crew. As Mark took his break, the duo decided to venture across the street to the Galaxy Disco in the Speedway Shopping Center, conveniently located across the street. Mark pulls out his black wallet that folds over 3 times, safeguarding his high school identification. However, with a meager $1.50 in his possession, the $2 entrance fee proved a hurdle, leaving them with no choice but to hang out outside. As the evening progressed, at 8:15 p.m., a phone call from Charlie interrupted Jane's managerial duties. Charlie sought a phone number to fix up a friend, prompting Jane to retrieve her address book from her red vinyl purse in the manager's office and provide the requested information, a seemingly ordinary interaction against the backdrop of the bustling Burger Chef. At 8:30 p.m., a group of friends, consisting of 2 girls and 2 boys, emerged from the Galaxy Disco, setting the stage for a communal return to the Burger Chef with India and Mark. Having completed his break, Mark seamlessly transitioned back to his work responsibilities, unaware of the unfolding events that would soon disrupt the ordinary rhythm of the evening. At 9:15 p.m., a friend takes George Nichols to the Dunkin' Donuts to visit with his girlfriend on her break from her shift. As the night deepened, unusual events began to unfold. Around 9:20 p.m., India noticed the entry of 2 poorly dressed Caucasian males into the restaurant. Their stay was brief, only about 30 seconds before they exited. These individuals, dirty and shabbily dressed, left an indelible mark on India's memory. One, aged around 25, stood at 5 feet 10 inches to 5 feet 11 inches, with light brown, shoulder-length, messy hair, a medium build, 175 pounds, and an appearance that suggested he needed a shave. He wore faded, worn-out jeans. The other, similar age and height, with hair resembling the first individual, but not quite as long, wore less faded jeans. It was a peculiar moment that, in retrospect, would prove to be a precursor to the unfolding events. At 9:30 p.m., India and Mark's friends left the Burger Chef, and Daniel gave India a ride home. At 9:35 p.m., a Caucasian male employee who was expected to be at work at 10 o'clock p.m. called the Burger Chef and spoke to Jane. He told her that he could not make it in as scheduled because the battery on his vehicle was dead. Witnesses stated that he had been in trouble and was fired earlier in the week, but had not been told of it yet. This night was supposed to be his last night. At 9:45 p.m., Daniel called home, seeking permission from his parents to extend his stay until midnight. He intended to assist fellow employees in the cleanup, since they were short-handed, and he needed the money for Christmas presents, which they approved. He assured his mom, Norma, that his car doors were locked and the car was parked near the Dunkin' Donuts side, where she always wanted him to park. Norma told Daniel she would wait for him, but he told her not to. A series of sightings and encounters would follow. Jane's father, George, was protective and routinely checked on her. At 10 o'clock p.m., he came through the drive-thru to check on Jane. Around the same time, a mother picked her daughter and her daughter's friend up from a roller skating party and drove to the Dunkin' Donuts that shared the west side of the parking lot with Burger Chef. At approximately 10:30 p.m., Kirk Thompson, Mark's friend, stopped at the Burger Chef with a friend from school before walking to the Galaxy Disco. Unbeknownst to them, this seemingly ordinary visit would soon intertwine with a sequence of events that would forever alter the trajectory of the evening. Mark and Kirk were going to walk home together. Simultaneously, the mother, daughter, and daughter's friend parked on the east side of the Dunkin' Donut shop. The mother noticed a light tan or dirty white four-door station wagon, with damage the length of the left side parked in the rear of the east side of the Dunkin' Donuts parking lot, facing Burger Chef while exiting her vehicle. The station wagon was old and junky. The mother walked into the Dunkin' Donuts. The girls observed a Caucasian male come from the Burger Chef parking lot and get in the passenger seat of the station wagon. He was described as a Caucasian male, with black or dark brown wavy hair, in his mid-30s, approximately 5 feet 8 inches to 5 feet 9 inches in height, 175 pounds, wearing a sports shirt. The two Caucasian males in the station wagon tried to get the girls' attention, but they ignored them. The driver was described as having shoulder-length brown or dirty blonde hair, a heavy wavy mustache, a medium beard, a white jacket that appeared soiled, Levi trousers, in his early 30s, 6 feet 1 inch in height, 175 pounds. At 10:35 p.m., the mother returned to the car and noticed the station wagon was now running with a loud exhaust. As they departed, their gaze followed the station wagon as it drove from the Dunkin' Donuts parking lot to the Burger Chef parking lot, and the driver exited the vehicle and entered the Burger Chef. As the night unfolded, the clock struck 11 o'clock p.m., signaling the closure of the Burger Chef. The standard closing procedure would take 1 to 2 hours to clean up the restaurant. As the assistant manager, Jane would be responsible for inventory and must count the receipts and place them in the safe during the cleanup so the day manager could take the money from both shifts to the bank at 4:30 p.m. the next day. One of the male employees, assumed to be Daniel, would have to take the trash to a dumpster behind the restaurant as the cleanup finished, which would have been the only time the rear door should have been unlocked. Meanwhile, an employee arrives early to work at the Dunkin' Donuts, so Nichols' girlfriend asks to clock out early. With approval, she clocks out at 11:11 p.m. His girlfriend realizes she does not have matches and asks Nichols to get them for her. Nichols sees the back door of the Burger Chef open slightly, with light shining out, so he runs to and enters the west side door of the Burger Chef. At first, he does not see anyone, but a few minutes later, a Caucasian female with shoulder-length blonde hair emerges, believed to be Ruth, to provide him with matches before swiftly retreating to the rear of the restaurant. Nichols returned to the back of the Dunkin' Donuts, and he and his girlfriend proceeded to walk to a fenced area behind the Burger Chef and sit down near the railroad tracks. As they continued their conversation, at 11:25 p.m., their gaze was drawn to two men approaching them from the east. The first man, a Caucasian male in his mid-30s with a full beard and mustache, stood at 5 feet 7 inches with a stocky to medium build. His voice, deep and raspy, hinted at a chronic smoker. Clad in a dark waist-length jacket and blue jeans, he held a blue and white bandana over his face. The second man, a Caucasian male at 5 feet 10 inches with dark, possibly black hair, kept his hands in his pockets and wore a sizable blue pile jacket. Their inquiry about identification led to an uneasy confrontation, culminating in a warning of potential vandalism and an order to leave. The couple got up and walked south along the edge of the fence at the back of the Burger Chef. Nichols looked back at the two men, and it appeared they were retracing their steps along the railroad track. They went through an opening into the Burger Chef lot on the east side of the parking lot, on the side of the building. There was a Vega on that side of the building. She looked in the window of the Burger Chef to see if there was a clock, and did not notice anyone inside the building. They continued walking between Dunkin' Donuts and Burger Chef. They walked back to the back of the Dunkin' Donuts building. Nichols went inside the Dunkin' Donuts to check the time and returned, letting his girlfriend know it was 11:30 p.m. Meanwhile, the Burger Chef's phone rang again, in which the male employee who missed his shift told Jane that his car had been repaired. Jane told him to come in and help clean up. He left and headed to the Burger Chef. Nichols and his girlfriend sat on milk crates at the back of the Dunkin' Donuts shop, where they saw headlights moving on the Burger Chef building, but would not see what vehicle they were coming from. It can be speculated that these headlights were from Jane's car as she made her way to Dunkin' Donuts, acquiring snacks and a pizza for the crew. As the remaining employees began their cleanup routine, a witness noticed Jane's car missing from the parking lot around 11:30 p.m. At 11:45 p.m., Brian passed the Burger Chef to take Ginger home from their date. Ginger noticed the lights were on, but Jane's car was gone. Brian asked if she wanted to stop and see what was going on, and she said she couldn't because she had a midnight curfew. Meanwhile, the mother and her daughter arrived home. At 11:50 p.m., Nichols and his girlfriend stood at the front of the Dunkin' Donuts shop and waited for her father to pick them up. Her father dropped Nichols off, and then they went home. At 11:55 p.m., Kirk leaves the Galaxy Disco to go to the Burger Chef and notices the Burger Chef lights. When he got to the grassy field area of the Speedway Shopping Center parking lot, he saw two males standing at the counter area inside the Burger Chef, approximately 300 yards away. The two men were about the same height and were not wearing Burger Chef uniforms. Relieved that he hadn't missed Mark because they were supposed to walk home together as a buddy system, he began to jog, slowing down at the side door. The parking lot was empty, except for Jane and Dan's cars. Looking through the locked side door, he saw no one, but the lights were still on. He walked through the lot to the back of the building. Little did the Burger Chef employees and the unsuspecting witnesses know that their lives would intersect with a dark and unfathomable fate. As the clock approached midnight, the Burger Chef, once a vibrant meeting point, now stood shrouded in an eerie silence. The routine cleanup had begun, but had not been finished. As the minutes ticked away, the Burger Chef, a symbol of community and shared moments, became the stage for a tragedy that would forever alter the course of Speedway, Indiana. The initial buzz of activity now yielded to an unsettling stillness, foreshadowing the events that had transpired within the restaurant's walls. As the Burger Chef entered its darkest hours, the surrounding area, once bustling with life, witnessed only the shadows cast by the lights within the restaurant, and the night held its breath, anticipating a revelation that would shatter the ordinary and plunge the town into a profound and enduring tragedy. The events of November 17, 1978, would etch themselves into the collective memory of Speedway, leaving an indelible mark on the community that had once gathered under the familiar glow of the Burger Chef's lights. The morning of November 18, 1978, cast a shadow over Burger Chef as mysterious events unfolded at midnight. The Burger Chef, usually alive with the hum of activity, now stood in eerie silence. As Kirk approached the back of the Burger Chef restaurant, he noticed the rear metal door wide open, an unsettling discovery from the usual secured state with a metal bar. A caution inspection revealed no signs of life within. He called out into the void, but the only response was the echo of his voice. Closing the door, he went home, unaware of the ominous scene he left behind. Around the same time, Brian concluded his first date with Ginger, dropping her off at her parents' house before heading to the Burger Chef. Passing the Burger Chef, he noticed the lights were still on, and Jane's car was still gone. He made a U-turn, approached from the southeast on Crawfordsville Road, and pulled into the Burger Chef entrance to help the employees clean up as employees had done for him. He parked by the rear entrance around 12:15 a.m. The door, open approximately 3 inches, beckoned him inside. What he found defied reason, a disheveled interior with cash register drawer inserts strewn on the floor, bills removed, and coins scattered about. The cash register drawers were closed, and Ruth's jacket was discarded on the floor. Trash containers were just inside the back door. The manager's office was in disarray, with both compartments of the safe open, bills missing, and several rolls of change remaining. Approximately $100 in coins remained, and $500 in bills had been taken. The cleaning procedure had commenced, yet the floors remained soiled, and the broilers stood uncleaned. Jane and Ruth's purses sat untouched with their licenses and other items inside, witnessing the inexplicable violation. Mark's glasses were also found. There were no apparent signs of a struggle lingering in the air. Jane's car was missing. However, Daniel's car remained locked, with his prescription glasses safely inside and untampered. Amidst the chaos, the employee Jane was told to come to work and assist with cleanup. He arrived 2 to 5 minutes later in his father's van-type truck. He parked beside Brian's vehicle, and as he stepped out, Brian came running out of the restaurant. Brian shared the grim revelation, but the employee, wary of involvement, departed swiftly. Brian wasted no time, contacting the Burger Chef manager to report what he had found. However, the manager told him to wait. The manager called him back and told him to call the police. At approximately 12:30 a.m., Brian reached out to the Speedway Police Department. Later, the investigation would identify a witness who lived near where Jane's car was recovered. While watching a BC late-night Beretta, which aired from 11:30 p.m. to 12:40 a.m., this witness was disturbed by an alarming noise, like a bang or a crash. This noise would later be attributed to a tree falling on a neighboring street. The police arrived approximately 15 minutes after receiving the call, around 12:45 a.m., and the wheels of a poorly executed investigation were set in motion. Former officers later revealed the depth of the mishandling, citing interdepartmental battles and a lack of protocol adherence. The assumption that the missing money resulted from a teenage escapade overshadowed the urgency of a proper investigation. In this bureaucratic quagmire, homeowners reported strange noises, possibly connected to the unfolding tragedy. A cacophony of chaos unfolded in the darkness of that November night, setting the stage for a haunting saga that would forever stain the history of Speedway, Indiana. As the clock struck 1 o'clock a.m., a usual time to complete the cleaning procedure at Burger Chef, an unsettling reality began to unfold. The four youths, integral to the nightly routine, were notably absent. In response, the gears of the Speedway Police protocol started turning, and the solemn task of notifying parents began. In the stillness of the night, Carolyn Freed received the unexpected call. The news of her daughter's absence sent a shockwave through her, resonating with a memory of Jane's pragmatic philosophy she would yield to a potential robber, prioritizing safety over resistance. Meanwhile, George Freed, a train conductor in St. Louis, raced back upon hearing the distressing news. The unexpected event stunned him, realizing that such an ordeal could touch his family. While anticipating a routine call from Ruth, John Shelton found himself confronted with a starkly different reality. The police's announcement shattered the ordinary expectation of opening the garage door for his daughter upon her return home. John, in turn, gently woke his wife, Rachel, to share the disturbing news. Norma and Richard Davis, too, were recipients of the ominous call, their emotional state concealed beneath a veil of uncertainty. The revelation that their child, along with 3 other employees, were missing cast a pall over their night. However, Robert and Blondell Flemons received no such call. The police, inquiring about their son, directed a simple question about Mark returning home from work and a request to notify police upon his return. Mark's continued absence prompted Robert to journey to the police station, seeking answers to the enigma that had unfolded in the silent hours of the night. Mark, known for his punctuality, had not graced his home, leaving his father on a quest for the truth, an unsettling journey into the unknown. The police did canvass the area with patrol officers and helicopters. A witness living near Jane's car was found watching NBC Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, which aired from 11:30 p.m. to 1 o'clock a.m. This witness fixed a cup of coffee and prepared for bed when the show ended. Another witness living in the same area finished visiting with his girlfriend and returned home, driving down the street from the end of the block and parked directly in front of where Jane's car was recovered. The only vehicle on the street was a white Plymouth belonging to the neighbors. Another witness on the south side of Indianapolis between the restaurant was asked for directions to Stones Crossing, which is where the bodies were later discovered. Two men and three women were in the car, and the driver's description fit the description of the first suspect from the railroad tracks. The witness described the car as a dark blue 1969-1970 Plymouth with mud flaps. Under hypnosis, the witness recognized one of the female passengers as one of the victims. At approximately 1:30 a.m., the witness, who fixed coffee after watching Johnny Carson, was drinking in her bedroom when she heard a car door slam. She looked out the window and saw a white Vega parked in front of her house. She thought the car belonged to her neighbor then, but the neighbor told her they did not come home that early in the evening. At the same time, the witness, who had come home from his girlfriend's house, heard a noise that sounded like a car door being closed or trash cans being knocked over. As the hands of the clock swept towards 3 o'clock a.m., the silence of the night was pierced by the shrill ring of Charlie's phone to be notified of Jane's disappearance. Also, police presumed that the victims met their untimely end in the quiet hours before the first light. Their lives extinguished under the cloak of darkness as early as 3 o'clock a.m. Charlie contacted Carolyn Freed upon hearing this news. In the pre-dawn hours, at 4:30 a.m., the police found Jane's abandoned car on the side of the 5500 block of West 16th Street in a quiet residential neighborhood, a mere 1.5 miles from the Burger Chef restaurant. The location, 2 blocks from the Speedway Police Department and Fire Department, bore witness to an eerie proximity. The driver's side door stood resolute in its locked state, while the passenger door, slightly ajar and not fully closed, whispered of an untold tale. The keys, once the conduits of control, were missing, adding another layer of mystery to the unfolding enigma. The Burger Chef morning shift schedule was 8 o'clock a.m. to 4:30 p.m. When the Burger Chef employees showed up for their shifts, the police allowed the crew to clean up the restaurant and open it for business as if nothing had happened. The employees were vaguely told about the robbery as they were interviewed. The police didn't dust for fingerprints or take pictures of the scene. Any shred of evidence was destroyed. In the wake of the unfolding tragedy, at 10:15 a.m., the Speedway police reached out to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, realizing the gravity of the situation. 11 hours had passed since the victims were last known to be missing, a presumed kidnapping evolving into a desperate search for hostages. The specter of FBI jurisdiction loomed, and assistance was offered, marking the convergence of local and federal forces in the pursuit of answers in the wake of a night marred by unspeakable horrors. As the gravity of the situation unfolded, a collective effort was set into motion to trace the missing Burger Chef employees. Reserve and off-duty Marion County Sheriff's Department officers joined the pursuit collaboratively. The Indiana State Police, recognizing the urgency of the matter, swiftly issued an alert, amplifying the search for any leads that could unveil the whereabouts of the absent youths. The resonance of the unfolding mystery reached the highest echelons of law enforcement, prompting the FBI to extend a helping hand. Their assistance underscored the severity of the situation, emphasizing the need for a unified front in the quest for answers. In this convergence of local, state, and federal resources, a beacon of hope flickered amidst the shadows of uncertainty, all committed to unraveling the mystery that had gripped the community. In the turmoil that enveloped them, Rachel Shelton sought solace in the familiar embrace of the Bible. As the uncertainty and fear gripped her heart, the sacred verses provided a sanctuary, offering a glimmer of hope in the face of the unknown. For Robert Flemons, the swirling thoughts in his mind found refuge in a poignant memory of his son, Mark. In the echoes of Mark's words, there was a comforting reassurance that transcended the grim reality. Mark had once shared a resilient sentiment with his father, a testament to his indomitable spirit. In the hypothetical scenario of capture, Mark envisioned a daring escape, a dance of evasion, a defiance against the shadows that threatened to engulf him. In Robert's mind, the image of Mark breaking away, bobbing and weaving, became a beacon of strength. Mark's determination to be a more challenging target, refusing to succumb to a passive fate, echoed with a resilience that fueled Robert's thoughts. In the face of the unknown, this cherished memory became a source of strength, a testament to the courage that defined Mark's spirit, a courage that, even in his absence, resonated in the hearts of those who held him dear. A ripple of disbelief surged through Ruth's family in the early hours. Teresa, her sister, was abruptly awakened by her brother, Gordon, bearing the distressing news that Ruth had been kidnapped. Stumbling into the family room, she found the phone ringing persistently, a haunting reminder of their lives' unexpected turn. In an era devoid of call waiting, the urgency at that moment was palpable. As her parents rushed to answer the phone, the weight of the situation hung heavy in the air. The telephone, typically a mundane fixture, now bore tidings that would reshape the trajectory of their lives. Without modern conveniences, the phone became a lifeline, connecting them to a surreal reality. As the day unfolded, family members gathered, offering solace in uncertainty. The air was thick with unspoken fears and the desperate hope for a resolution. At 5:30 p.m., a homeowner stumbled upon a gun in his yard, a mysterious artifact untouched by rust or exposure to the elements. Found near 21st and Cunningham Drive, it stood as a cryptic symbol amidst the unfolding drama, raising questions that echo the enigma of that fateful night. On the pivotal day of November 19, 1978, a series of consensual monitor waivers were secured from the grieving parents of the four victims and the Burger Chef Corps. These waivers allowed the authorities to install monitoring equipment at selected locations specifically. One residence, and the Burger Chef headquarters. The intention was to use this equipment to gather any potential leads or information related to the disappearance of the victims, such as ransom requests. However, before the monitoring equipment could be set into motion, a grim revelation altered the course of the investigation. The bodies of the victims were discovered, rendering the need for monitoring obsolete. The tragic discovery abandoned any plans for eavesdropping on the lines. The process involved obtaining consent to monitor forms from the families of the victims, ushering in a series of interviews as investigators delved into the heart-wrenching circumstances surrounding the disappearance. The investigation took a sad turn. The Indiana State Police, taking charge of the homicide case, received news from a concerned citizen. Bodies were found in a remote wooded area in Johnson County, Indiana, an eerie 22 miles from the familiar setting of the Burger Chef restaurant. Ruth and Daniel were discovered by Fred and Rosemary Hager at approximately 3:15 p.m. while taking a walk on their property. Fred knew that these two were two of the missing victims because of their attire and contacted the police immediately. Hardly any time had passed when officers and investigators from surrounding and associated agencies arrived on the scene. The sparsely populated wooded expanse east of State Road 37 and south of Stones Crossing Road in White River Township in northwestern Johnson County near Stones Crossing concealed the tragic tableau. The bodies of Daniel and Ruth were discovered about 75 yards from Stony Creek Road, lying within the solemn embrace of the woods. They were found lying face down, shot execution style with a .38 caliber firearm. Jane's remains rested approximately 30 to 40 yards south of Daniel and Ruth and 75 feet from Mark. Jane was found stabbed twice in the chest, puncturing her heart with such force that the blade of the knife broke and was left protruding from her body. Mark was found 75 to 80 yards west of Daniel and Ruth. Mark's body was discovered in an awkward position, the presumed cause of death for Mark changed over the years. Among these causes, investigators believed that Mark ran into a tree, Mark had been fighting the suspects, or Mark had been beaten with a chain. However, Mark ultimately passed away from choking on his blood. Despite the stark reality of their demise, none of the victims exhibited signs of assault or sexual molestation. Each remained fully clothed in their Burger Chef uniforms, and the absence of defensive marks or wounds hinted at a more enigmatic narrative. The woods bore witness to the silent aftermath, leaving investigators to grapple with the haunting question of what transpired in those desolate surroundings.
Thank you for choosing to support Allegedly Evident. If you enjoyed this episode, like, follow, share, and download it. We love to hear from the community. Feel free to share your thoughts and opinions in the comment section. Catch new episodes on Fridays.